We're thinking this morning about the cross of Jesus from that passage in Mark chapter 15 that Trevor read to us. Now, Jesus' death on the cross was absolutely crucial and central to his mission. And so the cross has now become synonymous with Christianity. It's a very popular symbol, maybe along with the brand of Coca-Cola, the Big M of McDonald's, and the Nike tick. It's the most recognizable symbol throughout the whole world. It seems strange that 2,000 or so years after this crucifixion took place, that millions of people in the world are still celebrating it. Celebrating the fact that this great young teacher, who had a lot of good things to say, was cut down in his prime when he was in his early 30s. Sounds a bit of a silly thing to do to a great teacher. But as we become more familiar with what's going on in this good news story that Mark gives us, we see a bit more about what Jesus' life has been all about, what Jesus' death has been all about. And we can't help noticing that there's more going on here than just a good man being cut down, a good teacher saying good things ahead of his time. Plenty of people have spilled ink writing about Jesus and his life and what it achieved. And some of those people were used by God supernaturally to write God's word down to be a true and accurate eyewitness account of what took place. And we have one of those guys here, Mark, who wrote his gospel with the help of several eyewitnesses. And I want us this morning to focus on what he's got to say about the cross. We're thinking this morning about the reality of the cross, what really happened. And what really is the point of it all? And as we do that, I just want us to focus on two questions this morning. Two questions. The first question is, who really killed Jesus? Who really killed him? And the second question is, what did Jesus' death really achieve? What did his death really achieve? So firstly, who really killed Jesus? Verses 16 to 32. Who really killed Jesus? I borrowed that heading from one of these programs that was on Channel 5 recently, a documentary that was on before Christmas. You know, these kind of things we get from shown on the telly from time to time. This series coming up later on Channel 5, Secrets of the Cross. Was it Pontius Pilate or was it the Jews? Who really killed Jesus? Find out after Home and Away. And we get these programs, don't we, trying to delve into, you know, what's really been covered up, what the real story is about who killed Jesus, who was responsible, who can we blame? Well, as we read Mark's gospel, indeed all the gospels, they seem to suggest there were lots of people involved or connected with Jesus' death. There were lots of people that wanted him dead, even though he was this great teacher. Even though the things he said were so powerful and so great and so true. But maybe that's actually part of the reason why some people wanted him dead. Let's look at some of those people. First of all, there were the Jewish religious leaders. They didn't like him because he was claiming to be God, just like I was telling the kids when he forgave that man's sin. He was claiming to be the Messiah, the long-awaited rescuer, the long-awaited conquering king, who was going to reign and deal with the problem of sin and establish his throne on earth. The Romans didn't really like him because they were the guys in charge of the day. They were the superpower that just had everything under control. They had this huge empire. And so they just let everything go vaguely as it was. So the Jews were okay because their religion was sort of fairly okay to manage. It wasn't causing a stir. It wasn't causing a big sect where loads of people were following and claiming power. So the Romans weren't too pleased with Jesus when he came along and started making this power play with all this following of people. Sometimes even Jesus' followers were a bit confused about who he was. There's a great bit in Mark chapter 8 where Peter, one of Jesus' disciples, is the first person to realize properly that Jesus is the Christ. He's the Messiah. He's the promised rescuer. But then Jesus goes on to tell Peter how, as part of God's plan for his rescue mission, he's going to have to suffer many things, be rejected, eventually be killed. And Peter is a bit put off by that. He's having none of it. If Jesus truly is the Messiah, why doesn't he just come in and deal with the Romans, deal with these religious folk, set up his kingdom now, and we can live under him? But not long after that episode, when Jesus and his friends had been out walking all day in the hot sun, when their feet were nice and dirty and smelly from the sand, Jesus, when they had arrived in the house, took up a towel, took the place of a slave, a servant, with his bucket of water. And this respected teacher began to wash his disciples' feet as a picture of the service he had come to bring. And he said in Mark 10, verse 45, "For the Son of Man," that's Jesus talking about himself, "the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." So throughout Jesus' life, throughout his times of good teaching, of healing, of forgiveness, something was hanging over his life. There was a purpose to it. There's a painting by a pre-Raphaelite artist by the name of Holman Hunt, which is called The Shadow of Death. And it depicts Jesus there as a young man working in his dad's carpentry shop. And he's there working away with the tools. And there's this light streaming in through the open door. And over the way the tools are arranged, it's cast this shadow beyond Jesus onto the wall of this shape of the cross. And below it are just lying around these carpenter's tools of the hammer and the nails. And it's as if the artist is saying, this cross is just hanging over the whole of Jesus' life. It's the purpose for which he has come. It's the whole point of his dwelling on earth. And so it's no surprise that Jesus calls what he has come to do a ransom. He's come to give his life as a ransom for many, a payment given to set people free. Jesus hasn't just come to deal with the Romans or the political problems, or to deal with people who are sick. He's come to deal with the most fundamental problem in every human heart, which is sin. That's what the Bible calls our rebellion against God. The very fact that we put ourselves in charge of our lives, that we turn our back on God, that we don't want anything to do with the God who has made us. And we live our own way. We disobey his right commands. As a result, we mess ourselves up. We affect other people. We do wrong to others. This is the great problem of the human heart. It's sin, rebellion against God. A rebellion that deserves God's punishment, God's judgment. But yet Jesus here is saying, I've come to deal with that problem. I've come to pay the price that rebels deserve. Me as the Son of Man, I'm going to come and give my life as a ransom, a payment in place of many rebels. And so Jesus is eventually betrayed and tried and arrested. And there's this murderer, Barabbas, released in his place to keep the crowd happy. And we pick up the story in our reading with the horrific physical suffering that's happening to Jesus. Did you pick up how many sort of things are done to him there? From verse 16, he's led away. They put this purple robe on him. They twisted this crown on him. They began to shout at him, "Hail, King of the Jews," mocking him. They struck him on the head. They spat on him. They paid homage to him, mocking him again. And then they dragged him around, took off this cloak, put his own clothes, and led him out to crucify him. Jesus doesn't fight. He doesn't wrestle with these people. He's there having all this horrific stuff done to him. But what does he say, said already to his disciples? He knew that this was coming. The Son of Man had to suffer many things in order that forgiveness might be possible for many. And so he is there, taken to the place of the skull. They nail his hands and his feet to this cross, the ancient and probably most horrific method of crucifixion, of execution. And as he hangs there, willingly yet excruciatingly painfully, blood pouring out of him, humiliated, in a place of shame. Did you notice there in the verses, he doesn't even take the offer of a few stiff drinks to help the pain go away. He refuses the wine on the sponge twice. And people begin there, seeing this spectacle of the man being killed, being humiliated. They begin to mock him. Shall we listen to what they say? They've dressed him up as a mock king, verse 17. They sort of bow down in a mock worship to him, verse 18 and 19. And then we're told about some specific mockers from verse 29 onwards. First of all, there's these passers-by. They hurl insults at Jesus. They quote one of Jesus' great claims back at him, as if to prove that he hasn't achieved it, that he was a false prophet, that he hadn't really been able to say what he was going to do, that he'd do what he said he was going to do. Then there's these religious people, the chief priests and the scribes. Again, they pick up on this theme of Jesus claiming to be a king, claiming to be the rescuer. And they say, come on then, Jesus, prove it. Give us a sign. If you were really this king, you'd come down off the cross. Prove it, prove it. If you prove it, we'll believe. And then to complete the set of these that mock Jesus, there's also these criminals crucified either side of him. And we're told, verse 32, they also hurled insults at him. Three quite different groups of people there from different walks of life, but all mocking Jesus. I wonder how you respond to Jesus' death. Do you think Jesus is a man who claimed great things, who was a good teacher, who had a bit of a good influence, but at the end of the day, he was just cut down, and when push came to shove, he couldn't really prove that he had the power to come down off that cross? Or maybe you're like the religious people, where you're content with your own life, your own way of the things you do for God. You're satisfied with just coming to church and being involved in doing those good things that you know you do. And you think that's going to get you accepted before God because you work your hardest, because you try your best. You don't need this Jesus person to come and insult you by saying that he has to die for you. So the question remains, who really killed Jesus? Who's responsible for his death? The TV show would think, well, was it Pontius Pilate? Well, he had a hand in it, certainly. What about the religious leaders? Well, yeah, them too, they were around. But actually, the real cause of Jesus' death, the real answer, is probably too shocking for a TV documentary to actually begin to portray or say. Because the real reason for Jesus' death was sinners, was rebels, like you and me. Who really killed him? Well, the reason he died was to die in the place of people who had turned their backs on God, to take the punishment that they deserve. So we killed Jesus. But yet also, this isn't happening outside of God's control. Just like Trevor prayed in his prayer earlier, the fact that since the beginning of time, God had this purpose in mind, that he didn't leave people who had turned their backs on him without any hope. He could have just judged the first sinners, Adam and Eve, there in the garden and just wiped out the human race and said, I have nothing to do with this anymore. He would have been perfectly within his rights to do that. But yet in his grace, in him not giving us what we really do deserve, God planned the death of his own son. The crucifixion. Not only all this horrible physical stuff that we've read about, but the fact that on the cross, Jesus took God's wrath, God's judgment, the punishment that rebels deserve. So who really killed Jesus? There are plenty of people involved, but it was part of God's plan to rescue a people from himself, a people who had no hope. So the Bible tells us in places like Romans chapter 5 that while we were still sinners, while we still turned our backs on God, God, out of his love, sent Jesus, sent Christ to die for us. And this is the demonstration, the ultimate demonstration of God's love for the world, that he sent his Son to be the one who takes away his righteous anger. I wonder how you'll respond to the fact that we all have a responsibility in Jesus' death. That without his death, none of us could be made right with God. None of our sin could be forgiven. But yet God graciously, as part of his sovereign plan, meant that to happen so that we could be saved. So that's who really killed Jesus. And then just secondly, another brief question to ask ourselves from verses 33 to 39. What did Jesus' death really achieve? What did Jesus' death really achieve? Because for some people, the extent of Jesus' death just stops there at the physical suffering that we've read about. Jesus has led this exemplary life, and yes, he suffered all these horrible things. Well, maybe he was just a really good example of how to be so humble and just a good person who suffers on behalf of others. Maybe he was just a great example to follow. Some people think that, like Mahatma Gandhi. We've all heard of him, haven't we? Another barefooted great hero from history who was so peace-loving. He said this about Jesus: I could accept Jesus as a martyr, an embodiment of sacrifice. I could accept him as a divine teacher. His death on the cross was a great example to the world. But that there was anything more than that, anything miraculous in Jesus' death, my heart could not accept that. So the question is, did Jesus' death achieve anything more than just an example for people to follow? Well, I hope as we've looked at this passage that we're beginning to see that it did. I just want to focus on one of the most important things that the cross of Jesus achieves, and that is forgiveness. Forgiveness. We thought earlier about how it was Jesus' mission to come and die on the cross. This was the only way people were going to be rescued from their rebellion. This shadow of death was hanging over Jesus, just like in the painting. Well, you might stop me and ask a question at that point. Well, why did God have to bother with all of that? Why go through the ordeal of sending your eternal Son to be made a man with all this horrible humility of being a human being and then being a servant and then suffering this horrible death? Why doesn't God just forgive us? Surely if he's the all-powerful God, he has the power to just wipe the slate clean, just forgive us. And just say, look, it's okay, I'm going to decide to forgive you, and it's all right. I'm going to forget all the wrong things that you've done. I'm going to forget the state of your heart, which just rebels against me all the time. Could God have just done that? Well, is forgiveness really that easy? Think about it. Doesn't forgiveness mean bearing the cost of somebody's wrong on yourself instead of making them pay for it? Forgiveness isn't actually that easy when we think about it. I know when I do something I shouldn't at home, maybe I should have done the cleaning, or I should have done something and I failed to do it. I know I've messed up, and then Ruth gives me a good telling off. And then I think, well, why can you just forgive me, please? You know, I'm sorry, please forgive me. And if I've really upset her, it's not that easy just to say, oh, you're forgiven, is it? Somehow that pain, that offence that's been created, has got to go somewhere. And so you're faced with a choice. If somebody has wronged you, if somebody has done something nasty against you, you're faced with a choice of either retribution, of either revenge, getting back at them, making them pay for what they've done to you, or you can take the pain of that situation on yourself and absorb the impact of it and say, yes, I know you've done wrong, but I'm willing to bear the cost of that pain myself and take it upon myself and thereby be able to offer you forgiveness. You either put it right back at them in revenge, or you take it on yourself in forgiveness. But that offense, that pain needs to go somewhere. It can't just be swept under the carpet. It's the same with God and the way he looks at us and our rebellion, our sin. We're storing up as we live against God a right punishment that's due to us because of our sin. The Bible talks about how all of us are just living, and if we're living without God in our lives, we are just objects of God's judgment. We're living under his judgment now, and we can't escape that on our own. We're just heading towards this sure and certain punishment that God stores up for people who continue to rebel against him. But yet God here, in his grace, brings forth his only Son. The only way he could do this was to send the Son who was very God, who was part of himself, to bear the wrath, to bear the judgment that we deserve, and therefore achieve forgiveness. There's a great illustration of what happens in forgiveness between God and man here in Mark's account. Mark's a bit of a film director sometimes in the way he writes his gospel. He's there shooting one scene, and then all of a sudden he flashes away to another place in order for you to get an idea of what's happening at the same time, and then he'll flash back to another scene. So we're there at the scene of the cross, and then Jesus, with a loud cry, breathes his last and dies a physical and spiritual death there. Verse 37. But then in verse 38, Mark pans away to this temple in downtown Jerusalem. And we read that this huge temple curtain was torn in two from top to bottom. Symbolic of the fact that God, who is a pure and holy God, who is a perfect righteous God, who cannot let sin at all into his presence, who therefore cannot let any human being into a relationship with him, it symbolizes that Jesus' death has now made that possible, made a right relationship with God possible. I suppose a couple of hundred years ago, people were trying to prove that we didn't need any temples, we didn't need any God. The human race was quite okay on its own. It was achieving great things. It was the master of its own destiny. The modern world was the great hope for mankind of what humanity could achieve together. There was no need for God. There was no need for this connection between God with a temple. But maybe in more recent times, people have began to realize that maybe we can't achieve it all on our own. That actually there is something out there. There is something supernatural. There is something above us as humans that we want to connect with, that we need to connect with. And so temples have become more popular. Religion and spirituality, more people are going in for that kind of thing, to try and search for what there is beyond this life. And so it's amazing to read in the gospel here that actually the true temple that everybody needs, the true connection between God and humanity, is the Lord Jesus Christ. By that curtain being ripped here, it's Mark showing us that Jesus is the true temple. He's the true way we can approach God. He's the true way we can have a real living relationship with God and no forgiveness of sin, so we're not going to be judged there on the spot in that relationship with God. So what did Jesus' death really achieve? Well, forgiveness is costly, isn't it? But don't we see that at the cross, Jesus' death achieved that for us? Jesus was abandoned on that cross so that we could be accepted by God. Jesus was punished on that cross so we could be forgiven. I wonder what your response is to the reality of what happened on the cross those 2,000 years ago. Are you like any of those passers-by still who think, well, he's just a good teacher, really? Well, let me urge you to reconsider your view of Jesus. Jesus never claimed to be just a good teacher. He claimed to be the Son of God. He claimed to come to deal with the problem of sin and to die a sacrificial death. Or maybe you're still content with your religious life of trying to please God your own way. Well, let me tell you, unfortunately, you'll never get there. Nothing we can ever do as humans is going to erase the problem with our hearts. The problem that by nature, we have a bias to go against God. Let me encourage you to come to Jesus, to trust in his cross, to receive the forgiveness that is possible because of his death, to know a true and living relationship with the God who made you. Not through any religious building or temple, but through the true temple, who is the Lord Jesus Christ.